Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kyung Moon Hwang, who is Professor of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Southern California, who writes a biweekly column for the Korea Times of Seoul. His books include A History of Korea and Beyond Birth, Social Status in the Emergence of Modern Korea. And he's the author of a recent study, Rationalizing Korea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kyung Moon Hwang.
Thank you.
And what do you make of the summit that just took place? Most of the analysis is that it was pretty underwhelming. A number of people who have been Korean analysts and have been involved in Korean affairs in the government have pointed out that the communique that came out of it that they both signed with much pomp and ceremony was in fact thin, and that the communiques in 1994 between the U.S. and North Korea and in 2006 between the U.S. and North Korea were much more substantial and substantive. So it doesn't seem like, in terms of the paperwork, shall we say, that much came out of it. But the theatrics seem to have worked, and I believe there's a great deal of relief in South Korea. What are you hearing from South Koreans?
From South Koreans, they've been, of course, much more interested in this than even the American press has been. I followed this live late last night through the South Korean live broadcasting, and you know they were calling attention to every little facet of what was going on. And for them, the summit was divorced from any kind of consideration of what Donald Trump had been doing before with the G7 summit or his troubles back home in the United States. All these things that we consider as important aspects of the larger context. To the South Koreans, it seems as though that this is a major step that extends the overtures that were made and the more important breakthroughs that were made back in late April with the summit between President Moon of South Korea and Kim Jong-un. So I think from their perspective, and I think from the perspective that we can take as well, despite all the almost childish theatricalities that accompanied this event last night, and despite the fact that there's almost no substance at all to that joint communique or statement that was presented, this is an important step. It's better than, I guess, not having any development that brought greater harmony or lessening of tensions between North Korea and the United States. Of course, the big question is whether this is going to be sustainable. And I actually have no idea whether that's going to be the case.
Well, in many ways, it would seem to me that the fact that President Trump is an ego-driven amateur might well have been why, if this has succeeded, and nobody's saying it's been successful, and everybody's suggesting that we're going to have to wait to see whether there's that substance to the follow-on negotiations. But the point I wanted to make was that, I mean, when you watch the president talk about the pristine beaches in North Korea and how you could put condos on them and what a real estate opportunity it is for the country being between South Korea and China, it's like you can't believe you're hearing that. But on the other hand, maybe it took an amateur to pull this off. I was watching the face of Kim Jong-un, and it seemed to me that he was just as bemused as I was.
Yeah, I noticed that too. You know, when he heard some of the translations of Trump's utterings off the cuff, he seemed bewildered but also bemused, as if he knew that this was coming, and he was just a realization of what he had expected and what he had been briefed upon. So that was interesting to see as well. And I think you have an important point to make that the childishness, the level of juvenilia that Trump displays in these kinds of events and settings might be the crucial element here to move things forward. Because ultimately, in the end, the United States should not play a role. And this is something that was explicitly expressed in the statement that was issued back in the April 27th summit between the two Korean leaders. And that is that this is, in the end, a Korean issue. And peace in the Korean Peninsula will be and should be and must be achieved through Korean actions with Koreans at the center. And so Trump has introduced, of course, a wild card into that reality. And so if the more immediate task is to just get Trump out of the way so that he doesn't do something that would bring about destruction, then, his childish or amateurish level of approach to everything in this case might actually be a good thing. I hate to think that that's the case, but that might be the reality here.
So there is obviously a great deal of sentiment in the South about reunification and their sense of fraternity with the North, obviously, mm-hmm. but the regimes couldn't be more different. And the political left, which is in power now in South Korea, has always been more open, sunshine policies they've been called over the years. And the right in South Korea basically brands the left as being naive about what this regime really is. I don't think there's any delusions about it, are there? I mean, it is the UN report in 2014 brands North Korea as probably the worst human rights abuser on the planet. But on the other hand, it seems to be, at the end of the day, a real dilemma for Kim himself. You know, if he's going to improve the standard of living of his own people, which is what he's promised, he's also going to risk the bubble that he's built up in terms of cradle-to-grave propaganda that the people in the North live inside of. He could be pricking his own bubble, don't you think?
Yeah, that's always been the slippery slope that the Northern regime has faced. So the more you open up in order to enhance prospects of material gain and economic development, the more likely you're going to face the realities of open communication and open access to information by the citizenry. And so that is still the case, and it's actually happening right now from all reports that we've gotten, that there is this half-underground wave of information, access to South Korean cultural media, and other insights into the wider world that will shatter, if not already shattered, the carefully choreographed image within North Korea that has been developed over 70 years now, centered on the legitimacy of the Kim family's reign. And so that is ever present. Of course, they were talking like this 25 years ago, too, when the current leader's grandfather died, that here now we are going to see the quick implosion of the regime because this contradiction cannot be sustained. And yet, of course, it was sustained or it has been overcome. And so I'm certainly not going to go up there and say that this is the beginning of the end of the regime because of this contradiction. And in fact, the summit, if it did anything else, it probably bolstered the likelihood that this regime is going to survive even stronger because it gave, for internal consumption, greater credibility. Although that legitimacy that's been based in North, that's been built up in North Korea is much more than just simply saying, hey, here, our leader now enjoys the stage on equal footing with the American president. But it certainly has helped the cause for the North Korean leadership. And I'm not talking just about the Kim family, although that is the center, but the entire regime structure and the structure of unequal and really radically exploitative hierarchy that has developed in North Korea.
Well, there's no question that much of their outlook in the North is based on paranoia and the belief that the U.S. is about to invade. And obviously that's in part rooted in their experience in the Korean War when the United States had the most ruthless bombing campaign that just destroyed almost every building in the North. So that's understandable. And this criticism of President Trump for talking about getting rid of the or suspending the joint exercises, saying that they are provocative, a lot of military analysts find that a little unpalatable because it's actually the regime in the North that's pretty provocative, threatening to turn Seoul into a sea of fire, which they are quite capable of doing. But in general, the paranoia of Kim himself, as opposed to the kind of state paranoia about being having to be on a hair trigger, ready for the Americans to invade or ready to repel the American invasion. They've been living with that for decades. But what do you make of Kim's own paranoia? I mean, there were three planes. His own plane couldn't reach South Korea. So they had Chinese lent them three 747s. Two were acted as decoys, one of which apparently carried Kim's private toilet because he did. he didn't want anybody inspecting his stool, apparently. At least that's the theory. So what's he saying?
That's all like urban legend.
Right. Well, this is being reported by Chosun Ilbo, which is a South Korean major newspaper.
Yeah, they have their sources. Yeah.
Right. So what do you make of his own paranoia? Is he still, even though this has given him a tremendous boost, this summit with Trump in Singapore, is he still looking over his shoulder? I know he murdered his uncle. He murdered his half-brother, both of whom were close to the Chinese. He doesn't trust the Chinese. Who's he afraid of?
You know, I think he's afraid of what is the most obvious, and that is an American invasion. And that is, as you say, rooted in history, and legitimately rooted in history. Of course, it's much more than simply the terrible experience of American bombing in the Korean War. That was used as the kernel for this enormous legitimation narrative that justified the Kim family's rule over the last 70 years. And so it's been dependent on this anti-American hostility, which is based on the reality of American bombing in the Korean War, but it's been, of course, completely inflated beyond that as a way to justify and legitimate the Kim regime. And so that is fundamentally what's going on here in North Korea. And so for Kim, there is this reality of a genuine fear of American attack, especially with Trump in power. But then there's also this utility of anti-American hostility, or this utility of this narrative that the Americans are on the verge of attacking North Korea for internal consumption. And it's all part of ultimately the process of maintaining the Kim regime and everything that surrounds the Kim regime in power. And so the paranoia partly is justified, but mostly it's a political tool, as it has been for the past 70 years.
Right. But if you get rid of the paranoia by getting rid of the exercises and reducing American troops in North Korea, which may not happen, but at least Trump is putting it on the table. If that's the glue, the fear of an external enemy attacking you at any moment, if that's the glue that holds a regime together, if you remove that fear or remove the justification for that fear, does that unravel the regime?
Well, you would think so, but it's not the only glue that keeps the regime together. There's this very strong anti-Japanese hostility, and so they can always tap into that as well. And in fact, that seems more likely as we go forward, if indeed this pans out as something that lessens the open hostility between North Korea and the United States. So I imagine that the Northern regime, if indeed the exercises are stopped, and if indeed there is a drawdown in tension, military tension and hostility between North Korea and the United States, then the Northern regime can point to the flip side of that, and that is the economic aid or the economic benefits that come with a friendlier relationship with the United States. I mean, there are various aspects of the grand narrative, mostly fabricated in North Korea to prop up the regime, and the American or the anti-American narrative is just one component of it. It's a very important component, but it's just one. They have other things to draw upon as well, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops as we go forward.
But just, you know, to pull back for a moment, it always struck me as being so unreal, this whole summit, and the fact that even before it began, Kim, in effect, had won, and there's so little came out of it. It just, I find it so extraordinary that a small country of 25 million people that can't feed its own people, that's the only country on the planet that's completely dark to satellites because it's, you know, basically little to no electricity, and they have, it's kind of a family kleptocracy. They have to resort to all kinds of crime, counterfeiting, $100 bills, drug trafficking, just to pay off the elite and keep them on board.
Yeah.
It's just, I know that there's a book, The Tyranny of the Weak, but that, to my mind, really describes it. So How did we end up with the weakest country on the earth, in effect, ends up with nuclear weapons and ends up being on the same stage as equal players with the United States? It's pretty amazing,
it's because
isn't it?
Of the it's because of the nuclear weapons, right?
I mean, well, that's how we all should get danger. A nuke. Is that what the lesson is here? If you want to be respected, get a nuke.
For this case, yes. I think that exactly is what has happened or appears to have happened. And that's the real danger or the cost of what took place yesterday with the summit. And that is that this has essentially justified the track that was taken by the Northern regime beginning in the 1990s of developing a nuclear weapons capability in order not only to defend itself against American attack, but to use it as a tool later on over the long term to get what it wants. And the first thing that it wants, of course, is regime continuity. And so that was promised in that statement yesterday, although there's not much substance to it. That was one of the things, of course, and that is security guarantees by the United States for North Korea. And so essentially what it did was it said, hey, the North Korean strategy worked. And the other thing that worked, and that was probably, of course, unintended, but then again, you never know with Trump, but he said in his press conference, you know, he was just going off in his typical rambling and incomprehensible way. But one of the things he said was, in order to go off on the track of praising Kim Jong-un, he said, well, Kim Jong-un, I admire him. He did an amazing job because when he took power or when he gained leadership, you know, he was very young and look what he's done, as if this was some kind of great feat on the part of a guy whose qualifications were that he was the grandson of the founder. Trump, I think, even used numbers like, you know, 1 in 10,000 people can accomplish something like that. That just feeds into the narrative within North Korea of the great special quality of this leader, you know. And so this is all unseemly and very distasteful, given the terrible circumstances faced by the North Korean people over the past several decades,
right,
and currently as well. But in the longer run, and maybe in the bigger picture, that, however terrible it is, might be worth it if indeed we get a de-escalation of hostilities, which means that we have a less of a likelihood of open armed conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, just in closing, though, if Trump is successful and gets reelected, and if he gets a boost from this summit,
God,
you know, the Trump dynasty may capture America. That is, frankly, my greatest fear.
Yeah, I mean, geez. I mean, it's, you would think that that's not a possibility, but yeah, I mean, Trump has absolutely zero appreciation for the significance of democracy itself. And for him, well, the people who appear most admirable, if that's the word, are other dictators. And so he sees himself as, of course, a strong man within and maybe constrained by a democratic system. You hate to think that someone in the United States can actually think like that and be elected to the presidency, but this kind of event demonstrates that might be a real possibility. So it is extremely disquieting, as you suggest.
Well, Kyung Moon Hwang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you again.
I appreciate it. And again, I've been speaking with Kyung Moon Hwang, who is professor of history and East Asian languages and cultures at the University of Southern California, who writes a biweekly column for the Korea Times of Seoul. His books include A History of Korea and Beyond Birth, Social Status in the Emergence of Modern Korea. And he's the author of a recent study, Rationalizing Korea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the Canada Research Chair of Comparative Political Economy at York University, Leo Panitch.